You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So this session, I will declare my own priorities. I have three children and four bicycles. They are all very carefully named, even my children. Laura has a huge pedigree in cycling, journalism and experience. She, beyond cycling as exercise and health and well-being, cycling is inherently political, like everything. And she's been at the forefront of writing about that and exploring that. She wrote an article 12 years ago about the rise of women's cycling, generally and specifically in sporting endeavors. And that's still a work in progress. There are so many areas of this that matter. Dave Walker is a cartoonist, amongst other things. He might tell you more about the other things he does that he's willing to admit publicly. Dave is, I think, most helpfully an advocate for helpful degrees of self-importance in the church through his cartooning. I think that's one of the things he does best. But the two of them are going to be in conversation with each other for about 40 minutes or so. There'll then be some time for Q&A. That will be recorded as this talk is recorded. So if you don't want your voice to be on the recording, don't ask a question because it's too hard to edit it out afterwards. But afterwards, Dave is hanging around a bit. Laura will be shooting off for some lunch, but she will be in G Books at 2:30 for a book signing and will happily chat to you then. I think that's about all I wanted to say. Shuffle in if you need to. If you need to leave for any reason, just get up and go. No excuses necessary. Have a great Greenbelt and thanks for being here for this session.
Hi.
Hello.
I like this.
Excellent.
You've just got it in your hand, but it's very close to my mouth.
So, Laura, fantastic to have you at Greenbelt. That's the first thing
you
to say.
Thank you. Fantastic to be here.
This is, and I'm going to put this, I've got one active travel joke to put in.
This
is our own little low traffic neighbourhood. Anyway, sorry.
No through cars, yeah.
So you cycled here.
I cycled from Kettering. I got the train. I stuffed my bike and far too much stuff in my panniers onto the train this morning. Just about made the train at St Pancras, and then I cycled here. But I basically did three sides of a square around Broughton House. But then got here. It was nice. Nice, actually. Nice roads. Lovely morning.
Yeah, excellent. So we're here to talk about your book, Potholes and Pavements, which I've brought along to give myself an air of being incredibly well prepared.
He is well prepared.
And it's all about the National Cycle Network. So first of all, I just wondered if you could tell us what the National Cycle Network is and why it matters.
Yeah, I'd be curious, actually. I guess, as you're here, probably most people have heard of the NCN, but is anyone not quite sure what it is? Okay, yeah, so it's a very particular audience because you're among the 26% of people in the UK who have actually heard of the National Cycle Network, which kind of blows my mind because anyone who cycles, you kind of get to know about it. You start seeing the little blue and red signs and then you think, oh, what's that? And then you learn about it. But it's really remarkable because think about the trunk roads in this country. We have national highways. And then for the rail infrastructure, we have Network Rail. And then for the cycle network, we have a charity called Sustrans, who do an amazing job, but they basically have kind of stop-start funding. They've got no powers to commandeer land. And so it's a very, very patchy kind of thing. But it's also the most wonderful thing to me. There's these wonderful routes that you'll all have heard of, and many of you will have ridden some of them. The Camel Trail. I did Hadrian's Cycleway last year, I think. And so many of these iconic routes. And then you've got the ones that go into the cities, the Bristol and Bath Railway Path, which was the first National Cycle Network route. And the more I learned about it, the more I realised what a fantastic story of people power it was. And what a remarkable achievement it was, actually. And I kind of fell in love with and gained a new respect for the charity Sustrans. I know that they get a lot of stick. People say, well, why, you know, some of the bits aren't very good. The CEO admitted that some of the bits were a bit crap, he said. And I think everyone kind of realizes that there's these sort of patchy bits, there's good bits, amazing bits, but then there's these sort of terrible bits. And it's because there's no real kind of central body that's funding and designating and managing, and there's no maintenance funding. It's a bunch of volunteers, many of whom have been doing the same kind of volunteering on the same stretch of network for 40 years sometimes. Some of them are in their 70s and they're still doing it now. It's the most remarkable thing. And I really think it's a story of the National Cycle Network is emblematic of the power of community and people. And, you know, really against all odds. I mean, I dedicate the book to anyone who dreamed big against the odds, because I really think that its backstory is that it's sort of people who wanted something better. They saw cars being prioritized in towns and cities, and they thought, well, what about kids who need to cycle? What about the short journeys that we're taking every day? And, you know, it no longer feels safe. And so it really is about that for me. And it's just the most remarkable thing that it even exists, given how little funding and prioritization and government support it's had over the years. It really is, I don't know, a bit of a story of hope and the power of community, yeah. I think.
So how did the book come about? What was the journey of Potholes and Pavements?
Yeah, so it started on a road trip between LA and San Francisco. San Francisco and LA, I'd gone to America. I was driving along the kind of beautiful coast road down there, and I was listening to the audiobook of Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck, the guy who wrote Grapes of Wrath and all that. And I just thought it was the most wonderful thing. It was this man traveling around America with his standard poodle, Charlie. I love dogs. I love this idea. We had a kind of caravan, and he just went around talking to people. And I love talking to strangers. I will kind of stop at the lights and sort of try and, if you catch my eye, basically, I will try and talk to you. That's one of my things. And I just thought, what a wonderful thing. I mean, I'm not John Steinbeck, but what a great thing to just travel around talking to people. So I had this in my mind, like, cycling around talking to people. I could do it in a smaller country on a bicycle, and wouldn't that be fun? And so this kind of idea percolated, and in the end Bloomsbury contacted me about a different project that ended up never happening. But then I had a contact there, and I said, well, I've got half an idea. And this was on a Thursday, and then the editor wrote back and said, great, let's chat on Monday. And I was like, it's kind of half an idea at this stage. I don't really, you know, it's not really formed in any way. But we talked about it, and I thought, you know, I could travel around with the National Cycle Network, just go around talking to people. And she said, well, why don't you make it about the National Cycle Network? And it was remarkable, actually, you know, looking back now, that no one had done it before. Sustrans produced a book called Millennium Miles, which was about the National Lottery grant that they won, $42.5 million in the sort of late 90s, which allowed them to develop from a few greenways to a kind of national cycle network as it was. And that tells this story, but it's in a very kind of, you know, it's made by a charity. There's pictures and words, but there's no, I mean, it's a very different thing to a, you know, a nonfiction book. And so nobody had really written about this before. And it was one of those moments I was like, oh, of course, you know. And actually, I think if it had just been about me traveling around talking to people, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as good as Travel with Charlie. So, yeah, it was all kind of a very long gestation period, but kind of ended in a happy chance.
So when you went for your journey around Britain on the National Cycle Network, I think it's fair to say there were some highs and lows, weren't there?
I did end up in the fetal position in a hotel in St Austell, crying at one point because of the hills of Cornwall.
Yeah, Cornwall was not a... Is it fair
to say... That was with an e-bike as well. My contact lens had broken. My eye was like googling, should I go to A&E? It's like scratchy eye all day.
Cornwall was not the most straightforward section, was it? I think it's fair to say.
Yeah. So when you write a kind of book pitch, you say what you're going to do in each area, and so I had a theme for each area, which kind of worked. And Cornwall was about kind of rural areas. And then there was the Isle of Wight, and I met a guy, a senior police officer, who was working on road safety and kind of using evidence. And so, yeah, there were some highs and lows along the way. And each area, as I say, had a theme. And Cornwall is incredibly hilly. But I really wanted to make the case, because I grew up in rural West Somerset. I live in London now. But I was very conscious growing up that... in rural areas, there's not really much of a choice about how you travel. You know, I learned to drive, all my friends learned to drive at 17. If you didn't, you were stuck with a bus service. We used to hitchhike, which seems bizarre now. But yeah, I mean, that was the only way really to get around it. The bus stop was a couple of miles away. And yeah, so I was very keen on making the point. And even in rural parts of Cornwall, you know, you could get 12% of people cycling. There's been some research about if you had e-bike availability. But unfortunately, the National Cycle Network in Cornwall goes up and down all of the little hills because basically it goes on the roads that nobody else wants to use, which are nice and quiet, but they sort of do this and then they do this and then they do this again. And then they, yeah, it was, it's quite...
Your pink e-bike was pushed to the limit.
It was, yeah, it was, because it had me, it had a shrub on it, which I was taking to my sister, and it had panniers full of stuff. Yeah, that chapter's cycling across Cornwall with a shrub. Yep. So I thought, you know, I just love a bit of whimsy, I couldn't resist, so I was taking this shrub.
So if that's one of the more challenging bits, what is or was the best part of the National Cycle Network?
Yeah, I think for me, there was a wonderful moment in Glasgow. So it was a bit of a haphazard tour of different bits. I didn't ride the whole thing. I sort of chose different bits, like the rural bits of Cornwall. I went to Wales, South Wales, there's some great plans there. There was a plan for an interurban cycle route between Newport and Cardiff, and it's 15 miles apart. It's fairly flat. You know, these things would be perfect. There's a lot of industry and jobs, businesses along the way. But it was only when I got to Glasgow and Sustrans Scotland had told me about this bridge they were building up there, and I was expecting some sort of humpback thing over a canal, like an old stone. I don't know why, because we don't really build bridges like that anymore, but in my mind that's what it was. And it was very hot. 2022 was the big heatwave year, and it was even hot in Glasgow. And, you know, it's a great, I love Glasgow, actually. It's a brilliant city, but it was like, the weather was great when I was up there. Too hot, actually. So we went out to... this area where there were two canals, a T-junction of canals, which had separated three different communities for the 100 or so years since the canal's been built longer. And it wasn't a little humpback thing. It was this almighty kind of metal bridge kind of spanning this T-junction of the canal. But it was also artwork and it was also kind of landscaping. And it was very much bringing an area which the community had turned its back on back into the community. It was somewhere where, you know, some guys might go to drink and it might feel quite intimidating after... hours after dark, and a local woman who lived in the area said she never went there at night time. And what they did there, Sustrans and Scottish Canals and a couple of other companies, was to really bring the community in. They had a disabled artists group, they had tiles made by lots of different artist groups and local people remembering the heritage and the history and the industry of the area. And it was really kind of opened my eyes to the fact that, you know, roads are places you go through, but actually cycle routes can be representative of their communities. And it really sort of, it was a light bulb moment for me. Oh, this is about people, ultimately. It's a linear park. It is a place to get from A to B, but it's so much more than that. And I think that's the wonderful thing that, that cycle routes can do. And I think those urban routes particularly, I mean, these rural routes, and I've said I care about rural areas, but actually, you know, most of our journeys, most people live in cities. And so if you can develop those little links, those little bridges, actually can make all the difference between someone either not being able to travel. If you're a wheelchair user, you might not have anywhere you can go and wheel safely. Or you might have to drive, and then suddenly just one little connection like that can just open up cycling and walking and wheeling to people. So that, I think those little connections are incredibly important. I know Sustrans in the last few years has been trying to do more of those, and they're incredibly transformative. So, yeah.
You say in the book that the National Cycle Network... it's sort of almost a way of taking the temperature for cycling provision in the UK as a whole. How would you say the patient is?
Yeah, my editor encouraged me to describe it as a patient and to do a kind of diagnosis. It's a funny one because it all started off as a bunch of volunteers. They built the Bristol to Bath railway path, which was an incredible undertaking in itself. And then there were other groups around the country who were trying to build their own routes as well. And so John Grimshaw, one of the founders, would travel by train and bike around the country and be a consultant, basically. Like, this is how you do it. This is how you get access to the land. There were a lot of disused railways, but most of those had fallen into private ownership. But, you know, there were a few that could be built. And then there was a big lottery grant, and they got a bunch of money to kind of draw lines between these disparate bits of route, which were literally just dotted around the country at random. And some of them were built as kind of paths, or they were connecting bits of seaside promenade, as in the North Wales coast, which is a great tourist route. But often when you got to the towns and cities, that's where the railway paths had been sold off to housing or industry. You know, that's where the land is most contested. And that's where, if you were going to build a cycle network, you would have to take traffic space from, you know, take road space from motor traffic. And that was the difficult bit that was kind of never done. And then there were bits of alongside a main road, you might get like a little narrow strip of verge that maybe had a bit of pavement on it. And they kind of drew the line there and said, well, it's not perfect, but there's no money to fix it. It'll have to do for now. And what kind of happened after that big, incredible, you know, they'd done 10,000 miles of national cycle network by sort of 2000, 2005, which is an you know, absolutely immense achievement from a charity with very little funding. And some councils had match funded the lottery grant, some hadn't. So safe to say it was incredibly patchy, especially in town centres where you need them the most. They don't connect to railway stations. And the fact is that in most... around most of the UK, I'd say that those connections haven't really been completed. They've sort of stayed as they were. The sort of bigger roads that the National Cycle Network ran along have gotten busier and more heavily trafficked, faster. And so they feel much less safe to cycle on. So Sustrans had to remove a bunch of the, de-designate a bunch of the network, and tried to get funding to reconnect. And, you know, to their credit, they managed to do a lot of the kind of activation projects to try and reconnect these bits. But a lot of it is kind of gappy or missing. And the funding just hasn't been there in any sort of concerted way to improve and connect those beautiful rural greenways to the train stations and the town centres. I remember going down to Bodmin Parkway to ride the camel trail, and I was really excited. I was on the pink e-bike, actually. I'd done my crying. I'd had enough of the hills, and I thought, where can I go that's flat? So I was looking on the map, and I thought, camel trail. So got off at Bodmin Parkway, and I did count the number of times I went astray. It was something like 15 times in 5 miles I went the wrong way, stopped. Some signs had fallen over, or I think I actually could have walked to the start of the camel trail faster. But yeah, so that's a big problem. That's still the case. And it's not just that I wasn't just picking on the National Cycle Network, as Dave said. It was about kind of taking the temperature of all cycle routes, because all cycle routes in the UK are subject to the same issues. There's no funding really, or there's a little bit and then no maintenance funding. It's not connected. Nobody uses kind of compulsory purchase powers and all of that like you would with roads. And so it's all about like negotiating with landowners. And if they don't want it, then you kind of have to wait. It's very patchy still, and a lot of the political will died down after the millennium years and the lottery funding, and it just hasn't really picked up since then.
So we mentioned before that it's a charity called Sustrans who oversees the network. Now that's a bit odd, isn't it, really? So what, I mean, are there any advantages of it being a charity, or is it a good or bad thing?
Yeah. And Sustrans is amazing. I mean, I think people reading the book come to realise actually what an incredible achievement it is. And I think the people who work there are generally people who want to make the world a better place. And, you know, they're being paid less in Sustrans than they would in a consultancy or a private firm or... So it's got a lot going for it, and it's got the most amazing kind of army of volunteers, and these are quite often retirees. You know, it's great for the retirees because they're cycling around every day, looking at these routes, cutting back brambles, keeping the paths clear. So it saves a huge amount in maintenance funding, and also it's very much of the community. There's a lovely one up in the Peak District on the Transpennine Trail that I went to visit with Xavier Bryce, the CEO of Sustrans, and it's a real community effort. There's a woman called Kate who's very kind of mild-mannered and you just wouldn't expect her to be the powerhouse that she is, but she sort of quietly just gets people to do things for her, basically. So you ride along and someone's put the back end of a bicycle into a bank with some wellies poking out, like someone's ridden too fast into it. It's just very sweet. And then somebody's done some carving for her for free, like wood carving, really lovely tree stumps with that are made into a fox or a rabbit. And it's a really well-loved beautiful route, and they do wildflower planting, and there's a kind of magic wood that they have a theme for, you know, depending on the time of year. So Easter there's rabbits and chicks, and then Halloween they make it really spooky. And so I think, you know, that really makes it unique, that sort of ownership by the community, and you just wouldn't get that on a road. We rode off from that bit of the Transpennine Trail, and the roads are just, you know, the roadsides are just covered in litter, and it really was quite a stark reminder of how different these places are. So there's that, and all the benefits that brings to the volunteers as well, so mental and physical health benefits, and, you know, just bringing people together. And I don't know, Xavier Bryce would say that it kind of escapes the culture wars stuff, having a charity delivering its charitable aims and, you know, building and looking after paths. But on the downside, obviously, there's no, Susterance has no powers, like I've said, to kind of manage the expansion. It can't prioritize funding, doesn't have funding. I mean, it has funding, but it's, you know, it's got no powers over its funding, particularly. It gets money from government that stops and starts. And they have periods where they had one back in October, they had to sort of get rid of about a third of their staff because they lost funding from Scotland. And and it's just incredibly patchy. They don't have the powers that a government body would have to develop in the same way that we do our road and rail network. So they do an amazing job and they do it incredibly cheaply, but the result is that, you know, good greenways and then town centres where you're on a random bit of pavement or just, yeah, you could be anywhere.
It would be it wouldn't be considered acceptable if major trunk roads were organised in the same way, would
no.
it? But we just
no,
we
it's true. It. Yeah, you just had to get off and push.
So you mentioned culture wars. Now I'm sure because you've been on. I know you talked to Jeremy Vine about cycling,
yeah.
and I imagine you got quite a lot of reaction to that. Sort of in that sort of setting, and
yeah.
when I post cartoons about cycling online, you know, that I get quite a lot of not particularly positive feedback.
Oh, do you?
Why do you think this is? Why do you think we're in a situation where there is this sort of anti-narrative about cycling when it could actually solve some of the problems?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, there's the kind of political element and there's the media element. And I think for a long time, the media has realized that if you write stories about cyclists being naughty, I'm being flippant, but you know what I mean. Then people click on it. And that's kind of the curse of the current funding model of modern media. That it is per click, and they know that it sells, basically, and they know that it gets people angry, and, you know, angry people share things and, you know, comment on things, and that's great for their revenues, advertising revenues. So that's kind of a very unfortunate side effect of how the media is funded. But then there's the kind of political element of the, you know, the wedge issue. So I think towards the end of the last government, there was very much an attempt to try and create these wedge issues, and the Uxbridge by-election was misinterpreted as an anti-cycling or anti-ULEZ vote, even though Labour had done very well and actually the Conservative incumbent hadn't. But, you know, because they still won, it was sort of interpreted that way. But yeah, I think it's just one of those things that's kind of used because it gets people riled up. It's interesting. There's a term, Ian Walker, he's at Swansea University in the academic, he's a psychologist, and he's termed this kind of pluralistic ignorance, and it's this thing, and it doesn't apply just to transport. It applies to all environmental concern as well. So the fact is, most of us want to see more investment in cycling and walking, and actually want to see more investment in the environment and are concerned about it. But we all think that everyone else doesn't, or most people around us don't want that. It's one of those bizarre things, and it happens at a micro level with things like low traffic neighbourhoods. So I think most people would agree that having, you know, safer streets for children is a positive thing and less traffic. But people think that everyone else feels differently to them, and so there's that problem as well. And politicians have this as well. They kind of suffer from this pluralistic ignorance. They think, oh, people don't support it, and if you go on social media, then that backs up this assumption. And so I think it's all of these things kind of feeding in, and I think that's where something, a physical space where you can kind of encounter people, and this is something that Xavier Bryce says, is can be so powerful. You know, you're just encountering people from all walks of life and on a path, on a shared path. And I mean, when he first said it, I was like, yeah, okay. But actually, the more I think about it, the more I think, yeah, you know, it does have that potential to kind of bring us together. And once these in kind of infrastructure investments are made, once the routes are there, it's incredibly powerful, actually, and people love it. And they think, why wasn't this here before, especially in rural areas? But even in towns and cities, you think, oh, you know, not having lots of motor traffic coming through my neighbourhood is actually makes it safer. Or having somewhere I can cycle safely into town, you know, I don't have to drive, is better. And it's kind of getting from here to there is a difficult bit. And that's kind of why you need political will and politicians who are willing to take the flak. But it's not easy. It's not an easy job to do. I couldn't do it.
Any thoughts about how we respond to this anti-narrative? You know, is the argument alone, you know, making the alternative case good enough? Or
I think it can do. I think, I mean, if you've got the energy to sort of counter stuff on social media, it really depends. I think for community interventions, so if something's being planned in your area, I think there's a lot of power in kind of supporting your local politicians who are trying to deliver it, and a positive message to your councillors in support, or even bringing groups of you together and saying, you know, we as a group support this, especially if it's not a cycling group. I think that can be particularly powerful if it's community groups or faith groups, or and I think, you know, because a lot of the time councillors will just hear the negative and they'll think, well, you know, why bother if I'm just going to get flak for this? It's just not, you know, it comes a point where doesn't feel like it's worth it anymore. But I think if you've got people behind you and you can be part of that constituency of support for a councillor, you know, a critical friend, but still supportive when things are being done that, you know, that you support. I think it's really important to have that kind of vocal, you know, to be vocal about it. I think that can make a huge difference, actually. I think it's something that people often underestimate, the power of that, because it's not often that people write to their councillors or their MPs. And when they do hear from people, it actually has quite a disproportionately large effect.
Go back to the book. There are some amazing statistics in the book.
Oh, yeah.
Was there one statistic that really took you by surprise?
Yeah, one of my favourite stories of the 26%, the fact that only 26% of people have heard of the National Cycle Network shocked me. But one of the stats that I love was when they were in a sort of very early days before Sustrans was Sustrans, talking about building a route that would eventually link Bristol and Bath, the very first section at Bitton on the old railway line. They had a bunch of volunteers, they had people digging, families would come along, the kids would be, you know, would kind of come along and supervise, and it was a real community affair. But they needed money for this kind of limestone dust that they put down, so they went to the family trust of Clark's Shoes, which is based in the southwest, and they said, you know, if we're going to build a nice rough path that's going to wear out lots of shoes, can you give us some money? So Clark's gave them 10 grand. And sure enough, they poured sort of 1,600 tons of limestone dust down on this path, a nice rough path that wore out lots of shoes. I just think that's just the most wonderful story. It's like they had to be real salespeople, you know, like really flog this idea.
So how would you say, I mean, what's the answer to improving the National Cycle Network? How, you know, what steps do we need politicians, national highways, local authorities? What steps do we need them to take?
Yeah, well, in Copenhagen, I went for the first time earlier this year to Copenhagen. I was very excited because they have a kind of inter-urban cycle network that links the city with lots of kind of little towns and villages surrounding. And that was a real communal effort between the national government and the city government and then the regional kind of little councils around. And they did 120 miles, I think it was 134 million euros. And then it was such an enormous success that they kept on building, and it became the one of the best infrastructure investments in the history of Denmark, I think, in kind of socioeconomic terms, you know, enabling people to travel more easily. Health benefits are always a big one. And I think that kind of model of, you know, central, regional and kind of local authority delivery is really the kind of key, and having lots of mayoral authorities coming online. So we've got a few already. And I think by 2026, something like 80% of the population of England is going to be under a mayoral authority. And I think they've got real powers to kind of deliver within their regions and start to connect up. And actually, the 12 of the 13 mayors of England in July got together and announced a national walking, wheeling and cycling network, and they're going to deliver in their areas and hopefully connect up to the surroundings. And they're supported by the national body Active Travel England. And I think that's the kind of way it needs to happen. National highways, I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole on national highways when I was writing the book, because I was conscious they call themselves the biggest builder of cycleways in England. And I kind of looked at that and thought, that seems odd. So I looked into it, and they have got an enormous amount of money, but it's spent in a very higgledy-piggledy way, basically on kind of pavements next to trunk roads, which no one really wants to cycle on. They have got guidelines, but they don't really use them. They have this loophole, which they say isn't a loophole, but it makes it virtually, they just don't deliver kind of decent cycle routes on the whole. There are some great ones. There's one near Lewes next to the A27 that's this amazing path. But, you know, they're building these enormous trunk roads that actually don't deliver on the economic decongestion. You know, you build more roads, more people drive. That's the sad fact of it. And environmental aims that they're supposedly delivering on. And so, I mean, I would like to see the budgets for national highways turned into kind of maintenance budgets, and using their engineering expertise and their ability to deliver, because they just commandeer land right, left and center very easily as a national government body. And so I'd love to see that kind of energy it's not to say we don't need any bypasses ever, but you know, I think they basically exist to make a case for their own existence, and there's great chunks of money going onto these roads we don't really need and can't really afford in terms of the environment. So I would love to see, and you know, if I had the powers, I would sort of turn the old tanker around of national highways and sort of redirect them into cycleway delivery, because they could deliver a national cycle network in, I don't know, a very short time.
I think we'll vote for you to have the powers.
Yeah, I'd love it.
Because it's very different, isn't it, for a cycle route. If one landowner objects, yeah, then that can scupper the whole thing.
Yeah.
Whereas for a road, you can...
Yeah, they just breeze through it. They just do it. It's amazing. And quite often they own the parcel of land around the road itself. So, you know, they've already got... You can build a nice cycleway behind a hedgerow. And, you know, it can be quite pleasant depending on the road and the situation. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I've got this follow-on project from the book, which is about writing a toolkit for rural path campaigners, because they come up against these landowner issues, and it's about how you navigate them and the funding and all of that, because it really is. And it's down to volunteers at the moment and amazing community groups, sometimes working for 10, 20 years on a little bit of path. It's quite remarkable, actually. But they, it's amazing, but it's very hard work.
Because the path in near Lewes to just outside Eastbourne is a great example, isn't it, of the path being put sort of mostly behind the hedge.
Exactly.
So it's sort of, you know, it's
amazing.
Both alongside the road, so it goes where people want to go.
Yeah.
But it's also apart from the road.
Yeah.
So it's a pleasant.
Yeah. And it's so smooth. Because they're used to doing motorways. So it's just the smoothest thing. They've got this little hill where it's like these perfect gradients. And they've got like, so it's so over-engineered. It's hilarious. They've got like, there's a little ditch and there's like five orange warning, yellow warning signs. Like, ditch warning, there's a ditch there. Don't fall in the ditch. And it's made me laugh. But yeah, it's great.
We'd take over-engineered, I think, wouldn't we? Yeah. General.
So smooth. Yeah, because sometimes you go along a path and you're like, I don't think this is machine rolled. I think this is like, just like jolting along. Yeah.
So while we're talking about the technical aspects of things.
Steamrollers, yeah.
Barriers. Sorry, this is not in the script.
Yeah.
Barriers.
Yeah.
That's one of the issues, isn't it? That a lot of national cycle network paths face.
Yeah.
In that if you're not just riding a standard bike, you can quickly come up against barriers that mean the whole route is inaccessible.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. And quite often, because it's on, Sustrans has a lot of agreements with landowners, and quite often landowners and councils actually are concerned about off-road bikes using the pass, but by preventing the off-road bikes, which they often don't actually, it often doesn't work, because off-road bikers are quite, they're quite sort of resourceful.
They can go off-road, I guess.
They can just go around, they can just go off-road, just like fly over the hedge. I don't know, they somehow manage to get on there. But yeah, these barriers, built with good intention, but actually prevent sort of non-standard cycle users. I've had to remove my panniers even off of some, and you know, I can lift my panniers off or lift my bike up, but a lot of people can't. And actually these paths can be incredibly powerful for people with mobility scooters or people in wheelchairs, especially in the countryside where there's nowhere safe. You know, you can't exactly go on the road, the pavements are often narrow and bumpy and covered in parked cars. So that's a really important one, and Sustrans is working to remove the barriers. They had sort of three every mile on the off-road sections of the NCN. That's the kind of scale of the problem that they're up against, and they remove some, but then councils will put them in, and there are other ways of tackling it. Ed Plowden, who's now a Bristol councillor, he back in the day was in Bristol in charge of putting barriers in, and then ironically later on he became the guy removing the barriers for Sustrans. So he was probably removing some of the barriers he put in, but he said in the end they would just take away the bikes and crush them, and that stopped people from going on the paths largely. So it's a good incentive.
So since the the book was a year, since then, just so that we are all kept up to date with the latest developments, you met with the previous Secretary of State,
Louise Hague.
And she was she was a fan. Is that fair to say?
I noticed she followed me on Twitter, which was a bit, and then I messaged her. I sent her a cheeky message and I was like, oh, do you fancy, because she became the minister, the blinking minister for transport. And I was like, oh, do you want to, I didn't expect her to reply. Do you want a copy of the book? And she said, yes, please. This is where you send it. And so I went to Bloomsbury, signed my copy, did like, here's to transport choice, smiley face, cheeky smiley face. I might have even drawn curly hair on it. I don't know. Got carried away. But yeah, then she read it, and I was cycling in France with a friend. We did the Avenue Vert from Dieppe to Paris, and I looked on my phone when we stopped, and I had a bunch of messages, and it was links to this tweet, and she tweeted that she was reading it in the holidays, and I was sort of riding along crying with my friend Claire, just like, I can't believe it, I didn't expect the minister to, but yeah, she liked it. So then I got a message that she wanted to go for a bike ride with me. So we went for a bike ride, me and her and Chris Boardman. It was the most surreal thing, because like the previous transport minister was Mark Harper, who was like the kind of low traffic neighbourhood conspiracy theory guy. Like he was literally repeating kind of wild conspiracy theories that he'd seen on the internet. That clearly weren't true about councils forcing people to do X, Y, Z. I mean, he was in charge of transport. He should have known that this was a blatant lie. Bizarre, but she actually knew her brief. She was amazing. She actually knew what she was talking about. I was kind of blown away. From that to her was just night and day. And so she was like unprecedented funding for walking and cycling. It got on all the front pages. We put it on the podcast. It got on all the major front pages of the newspapers across the political spectrum. But then unfortunately she had to resign. But I think maybe the National Walking, Wheeling and Cycling Network is maybe inspired, but I don't know. But anyway, I think some stuff was put into train, and that's still continuing now. Heidi Alexander's much more cautious, I would say, much more kind of about maybe a bit more status quo, a bit yeah. Did was transport deputy mayor for transport in London and delivered cycling stuff there, but is not as bold as Louise Haig was.
Yeah. So are we, I mean, how hopeful are we about this new, the National Walking, Wheeling and Cycling Network? I mean, are we thinking that it will be funded? Because isn't that, that's the key thing really, isn't it?
So there's no specific new funding for it. And actually, the 3,500 miles that were announced with these 12 mayors, which included all parties, one of the reform mayors as well, who typically aren't that into cycling. I think he was peer pressured into it, actually. I think one of the other mayors apparently stood over him and was just like, just sign it. And so he just signed it. This is what I heard.
At a mayor
just
gathering.
Just sign it. Yeah. So, yeah, that's peer pressure for you. And, I think... So, yeah, all of the 3,500 miles are already planned. So it's school streets, it's kind of town centre improvements. It's not what you would call a cycle network. So that's the kind of reality of it. But I think what matters is that it's 12 of the most influential politicians in England who are in charge of delivering transport in their regions and have actually substantial budgets to deliver. You know, each of them has a city regional sustainable transport fund and all sorts of bus funding and pots that they can draw from. And I think just having that as a kind of goal is a great first step. They're meeting with Active Travel England every 4 to 6 weeks. And so they're going to start developing. They're going to have to be honest about what they've got already, that a lot of it will be, you know, bad, will be painted lanes on roads. And then they'll have to start to kind of deliver it as a network and link it up and stuff. But I think, you know, as a kind of statement of intent from 12 very, very influential mayors, with more mayors coming on board, I think there's real powers. And you think about the Copenhagen network, that was delivered regionally with national support. And so I really think that that's where the kind of transport innovations are happening, you know, bringing buses back under regional control. And so I think there's definitely reasons to be hopeful, but there's, you know, it's to be seen what will actually happen.
Yeah. So I had a question. In the last chapter of the book, you talk about things that need to happen, things people can do.
My manifesto.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are there any key points from that that we as a... that we, you know, anything that we can do to improve the lot of cycling?
Yeah, I think as kind of citizens and as members of communities, we all have a power to kind of support and to push for an agenda. And I think, you know, if you want kind of better transport options in your area, that contacting your local councillors, your MPs even, and talking to them about issues and transport choice, because often a lot of us don't have a choice other than to drive, and that's still the case, that's really powerful. I think getting together as groups, I know that there are community groups trying to deliver paths, and I'm doing this toolkit to try and gather some of their expertise and put it in one place so that they can, you know, learn from each other. I think if you can support those groups, that has a lot, there's a lot of power in that as well. And yeah, and I think it's important to kind of get out in the world and, you know, communicate with each other face to face and sort of talk about what you want your neighbourhoods to look like and kind of get away from some of the culture wars and kind of remind each other that actually most people want this, and this is, you know, ultimately a positive thing that kids can get around without having to be driven everywhere, and people of all abilities can get out and get exercise or get to the shops without having to own a car. I think it's really powerful too.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, what's next for you? Do you have you've already mentioned this,
yeah,
the toolkit, but do you have other projects?
Yeah. So that's kind of the one I'm trying to finish off at the moment. So I get to just travel around talking to people, talking to amazing campaigners who've been trying to deliver stuff for decades, and some of them are doing quite well. So I'm doing that. No more books on the horizon yet. Who knows? I mean, given how long the last one took me to think up, who knows, maybe 2030. But yeah, if an idea pops into my head, then maybe. But yeah, otherwise, journalism. I've got my podcast, Streets Ahead, doing that, and it's keeping me busy. All of that.
Substack.
Oh yeah, I've got a Substack. Yeah, you've got a Substack. Yeah, everyone's got a Substack now. Yeah, but I think we're going to... I don't know if people have got questions.
Yeah,
Q&A. Yeah, Q&A time. Okay.
So we've got a good 15 minutes for some Q&A. Oh, you're very keen people. That's excellent. Just a little bit of The clue's in the title. Questions, please. We've all got stories, and stories really matter, but we'd like concise questions that give Dave and Laura a chance to respond to as many as possible. Helen is going to be bringing the microphone as close to you as possible. I'll point out people that we'll take, and then she'll bring that as close. You may need to move a bit to do that. Helen will hold the microphone to your face and then look at you imploringly as though you need to begin now, and then please do. Please don't presume that the microphone will do all the work. So use your voice, because hearing each other's questions and things is really important now, okay? And we'll take as many as we can before we finish off at 1:30. And I am going to mix up the questions in terms of the diversity of our audience to make sure that we get voices from different people who look different anyway, even if you have lots of things in common. So where shall we begin? Let's begin with a lady.
So I have a borough councillor who is very in favour of cycling. In fact, he lent me your book, which is currently sat on my bedside and I haven't read it yet. And my MP, who does cycle occasionally, is Heidi Alexander.
Oh.
So if I'm going to write to Heidi, having been here, what shall I say?
Ooh. Goodness me. Read Laura's book now. I think just express your support for active travel is probably a good start. Thinking the How to Win Friends and Influence People book, that's probably a no. Yeah, just tell her, I don't know, tell her you support it, I guess, and say that you want to see more investment. And I mean, because, I don't know, airport expansion doesn't really work, does it? And road expansion doesn't really work. We kind of, active travel is such a great kind of, I mean, I've heard it described as a problem solver. So, you know, we have a lot of problems in terms of public health. You know, we're getting less healthy as a nation. I would say, you know, it's a great problem solver, that it, you know, it could solve health issues, decongestion of our streets, environmental. It just ticks so many policy boxes, and maybe, yeah. So we need some more money spent on it.
Okay, hi.
Hi.
Earlier, you talked about sort of how it took 11 mayors to bully a Reform Limited mayor into signing something completely benign. Or in fact, rather good. So, in view of Reform Limited's promise to actually get rid of cycle lanes and things like that if they got into power, how concerned should we be? How many cartoons do we need to draw in order to draw attention to it? How many shrubs do we need to cycle with to be able to handle this? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, they don't seem to be that effective. I mean, a lot of them are either resigning or they're not turning up to meetings. So I'm not really sure what's long term for them. I mean, obviously, they're sort of dragging the other parties towards the kind of right and their agenda, which is worrying. But I do think that sort of speaking up in favour of active transport, you know, I've never said this before, but has a lot of power. And I would just keep doing that, reminding our politicians that actually, you know, we don't want to see more car dependency. That hasn't worked. It doesn't work. And that we need sort of transport choice. I think it's good to kind of underline the choice element. And like childhood freedom is one thing that they're trying to underline with this National Walking, Wheeling, Cycling Network. It's about kids' freedom, which I think, you know, is hard to kind of argue against, whatever your political persuasion is. Yeah.
What is the overall goal that we're trying to achieve? And what should we prioritise to achieve that goal?
Yeah. So I think it's about, like I said, it's about choice, really. It's about kind of having the option to travel in the way that you want to and not just, you know, having to drive everywhere. And I think it's kind of pick your issue, really, in a way. You know, if you are concerned about community cohesion, we know that streets with fewer cars on, people know each other more, people know more of their neighbours. If you're concerned about health and well-being, you know, too many of us are inactive and don't really have a way to kind of weave activity into our days. I mean, I studied nutrition at university, and, you know, one of the things is like getting people to just get kind of activity into their days. It's not something separate. You know, if you're thinking about the environment, it ticks that box. And I think you can really kind of, depending on, you know, it's another thing about talking to politicians, depending on who your politician is, they are going to have their own priorities, and it could be any of the above or more. And the great thing about walking and cycling is that it does kind of solve so many problems. I think it's such a kind of flexible thing, and such a positive thing, which is why I still love doing it, writing about it after all these years. Yeah.
Cycling Twitter had a brilliant few years, given that it's now a completely toxic environment. I'm over here. Hello.
Oh, yeah. So
given that it's now turning into a really toxic environment, where are all the cool kids hanging out? Aww. Where's the best place? You know, and we've got Mastodon and Blue Sky. And where is the kind of cohort of good voices?
Well, I'm on Blue Sky. I'm not really, I don't know. Yeah, I've got put off social media a bit by Twitter, because there were some really quite nasty interactions. I remember it was a couple of years ago, I think. I had one particularly bad one. I just thought, geez, and I reported it to Twitter, and they did nothing. And I just thought, wow, okay, this is not really a safe place anymore. But yeah, I mean, I'm on Blue Sky. I like to adopt things late. So I kind of let other people make all the mistakes. And then like 5 years later, I'll come along and be like, okay, this is the thing everyone's settled on. So I'm on Blue Sky. That's the only one.
Is there a question from the Hothouse Lowlands somewhere?
We are on a slope.
Right at the back. If you want to come forward, and we'll have... Would you... Yeah. So you want to take the...
You'll need to come closer. Not going to make it.
Oh, will the cable make it? Got a bit of a...
Yeah, I'm a veteran of the funkier Grimshaw years. Are you? And I think the world needs a biography of John Grimshaw, who has just turned 80 and is still building cycle routes. Yep. So I think that's your next book.
Oh, yeah, he got a bit embarrassed actually about the book, because he felt like it sort of foregrounded him too much. But yeah, he did just turn 80. He does these annual work camps. They're down in Shepton Mallet again this September for the final time, because, you know, at 80, camping in a quarry for a week and doing manual labour all day is probably asking a bit too much of him. He's got an amazing level of energy, actually. I went on a little day trip with him for my past project down to Lewis, and he left Bristol at the crack of dawn, taken a train through Victoria, was advising people, meeting with landowners, and then headed back. And I said, oh, are you getting quiet weekend now? He's like, no, I'm off hiking with got some friends staying this weekend. We're off hiking. I'm like, okay. All right. Well, I hope that I'm as good as he is at 80, but yeah.
If you had to choose, would you favour developing cycleways in towns because there's more people and they need them more, in the countryside because it's better for leisure?
It's such a tricky one. I mean, in terms of if you want to get more people cycling, obviously cities and towns, there's more people. And I don't think that rural paths are just for leisure. I think in France and in the Netherlands, when they built rural paths decades ago, they found that actually, even though they were intended for leisure, a lot of people were using them to get to stations and to get to work. So I think both can do both. And I think it's kind of unfair that we're having to choose, and very much the funding model focuses on towns and cities, and it is quite hard to get rural paths. But in a way, I think, you know, rural paths can be more important, because there literally is no choice for a lot of people living in the countryside but to drive, because the roads are fast and narrow and there's no pavements. So yeah, it's impossible to choose, really. It's a shame that we think we kind of have to. Yeah.
Yes, Laura, I can empathize. Vincent Manchester, cycling instructor, Sustrans supporter and volunteer and friend of the Fallowfield Loop.
Yes,
I can empathize with you. A few years ago I cycled on a non-e-bike through Cornwall on my way to John O'Groats. Anyway, my question is generally, the NCN, yes, great idea, but to what extent is it just encouraging more leisure cycling and doing very little to influence modal shift, getting us out of our cars and doing something more active? And generally, should we really be looking at in the bigger picture, reallocating road space away from motor transport and slowing speeds. 20 is plenty.
Yeah. It's a good point. The National Cycle Network was always intended as a kind of the trunk roads of the cycle network. It wasn't that everyone was necessarily going to cycle from Dover to Inverness, but along the way, the point is that it picks up lots of kind of settlements along, you know. It is kind of supposed to be a kind of connecting spine into which regional routes will link. But of course, the difficult bits, like I said, in towns where you have to reallocate the road space in order to build safe cycle infrastructure, that's the bit that didn't happen. There are examples, great examples of where it's helped people to commute by bike, Bristol to Bath Railway Path, this example in Glasgow and the Stockinfield Bridge, and lots of kind of little urban connectors, bridges and things like that. But yeah, ultimately it kind of doesn't fully serve its own purpose because of the problems of, you know, the Sustrans can't reallocate road space ultimately. So yeah, it could do, you know, it could and should go through towns and link up train stations.
Thank you. I've recently cycled from Tynemouth to Edinburgh.
Ooh.
And the A1...
Coast and Castles.
More or less.
Yeah.
But the A1 up in Northumberland tried to take the cycle routes, tried to take me onto there, and it was just an absolute disaster.
Oh, yeah.
But it's given me like a real passion again for a longer distance cycle.
Yeah.
Out of all of the different rides you did in your book, if I was to go on a longer cycle route, what would you recommend to me as a really good ride?
Yeah, that one's really good. I did that one. That was one of my early experiences on the NCN. I loved Hadrian's Cycle Way. I was meant to do the Way of the Roses last year as well, but I just had COVID and I hadn't quite recovered. But I've heard that one's a really beautiful route. North Wales coast is really nice, actually. The Anglesey bit's kind of okay, but once you get across the Menai Strait and then along there is beautiful, and it's mostly off-road because it's on promenades, seafront promenades, is really nice. There's a couple of hills at the end, just before you get to Chester, and that's a good one. Caledonia Way is amazing. And there was a little bit, actually, that was rebuilt that I visited in 2019 that was rebuilt along the, or introduced along the lock front, and that was, even though it's a rural path and it's part of a long distance route, that enabled local children to cycle to school where they had just a busy road or a muddy beachfront, basically. So, but yeah, that's a really lovely, that's ridiculously beautiful. And it's not too hilly. So yeah. Love to do that one again. It was so nice. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your talk. Why do you think it is that so many people are so angry about cyclists? And sort of a follow-up question to that, what can we do to actually like change the general opinion about cycling?
Yeah, it's one of those strange human phenomenons, I think, of just kind of out-grouping. And I think it's partly because, because cyclists are fewer, and so I think it's easier to kind of see one, the behaviour of one, as representing the behaviour of all. And it's funny because you can see bad driver behaviour on sort of equal proportions, but we just totally overlook it. Like you say, it's just very, very particular to cycling. I don't know. It's quite, I think imagery is really important, like how you kind of depict and talk about cycling, because it could and should be for young people and women and older people. I think having that kind of more just representing kind of different users more, or maybe looking to examples from other countries, and like, you know, cycling doesn't have to be. And I think having conversations with people as well can really cut through. I think face to face we want to agree with each other, whereas online it can be much easier to be rude to people. I think face to face, when I've had chats with people and you kind of explain it and they think, oh yeah, like I didn't realize. I think a lot of it's just misunderstanding, like why is someone in the middle of the lane? They're just trying to get in my way to annoy me. But then when you say, well, actually sometimes it's not safe to overtake, you need to kind of be in the middle of the lane so that someone doesn't, you know, try and overtake. And then they say, oh yeah, okay, yeah. And yeah, I just think having those conversations can be really powerful. Yeah.
I'm afraid we're out of time. If any of you wanted to ask a question, you didn't get a chance, come and shout at me afterwards, politely.
Or I'm doing my book signing.
Yeah, a few things to take away. For me, I mean, the wisdom of if you want to meet yourself, take a bicycle and a shrub to Cornwall and see what happens. The importance, I think, Laura, of adventure. You know, yeah. As adults, we lose adventure in our lives too quickly. And true. The challenge to advocate for adventure for other people and making that possible is a really important thing.
Yeah.
And I take all of those away myself. As I said earlier, Dave is hanging around, so you can chat to him as much as you like. In the nicest possible way, Laura doesn't want to talk to any of you because she's going for lunch.
That's not true. I just need to eat.
But she is going to be in the bookshop at 2:30 for both signing and an interview. Is that happening there?
Yeah, signing, yes.
And interviews in the bookshop as well.
I think the interview's in the little press area. I'm doing an interview about camping.
That's not with other people or...
No.
Okay.
But then we're doing another panel.
There's another panel here that Laura's involved in. Yeah, Anna's involved.
Yeah.
Okay. So Laura's around. Go and find her. And can I say thank you for coming. Thank you for your questions. They were excellent questions. Thank you for sitting next to each other as strangers for a moment. And wherever you're going next, have a great time. But can we say thank you to Laura and to Dave?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.